She is about to kind of enter the Thunderdome in a way that I don't know if she is ready for.
Welcome to the Powers That Be Daily, Puck's podcast focused on the intersection of Wall Street, Washington, Silicon Valley, and Hollywood, and the players who run it all. I'm Peter Hamby. It's Friday, March 29th. Today, I'm joined by Teddy Schleifer to talk about Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s new running mate for president, Nicole Shanahan, a 38-year-old Bay Area entrepreneur and Burning Man fixture with lots and lots of money. Teddy has reported on Shanahan for several years and explains why somebody who has long avoided the spotlight has suddenly decided to sign up for a heavily scrutinized and controversial presidential ticket in 2024. And later, Bill Cohan joins Ben to discuss Trump's extraordinary multi-billion dollar SPAC windfall and the questions surrounding whether he can use his new wealth to solve his massive legal bill with the state of New York. We'll discuss all that and much, much more on today's episode of The Powers That Be.
Hey, I'm Brett Podolsky, co-founder of The Farmer's Dog. We make fresh food for dogs. We started the company when we saw what a huge difference it made in my own dog, Jada, when she stopped eating ultra-processed kibble and started eating fresh, whole food. The Farmer's Dog food isn't fancy. It's just real food delivered to your door in pre-portioned packs. It's better for them and easier for you.
Get 50% off your first box at thefarmersdog.com/podcast. That's thefarmersdog.com/podcast.
Happy Friday, everybody. Welcome to The Powers That Be. I am joined today by Teddy Schleifer, who is on Amtrak currently as we're recording this, heading to the SBF sentencing in New York on his way up from DC. Teddy, thanks for joining me. I hope you're not in the quiet car.
I won't tell you where in the train I am to find the absolute absolute quietest place, but we take audio quality seriously here on The Powers That Be. So I go where I need to.
We sure do. Thanks to our producer, Bob. Teddy, history rarely remembers third-party running mates, maybe with the exception of Admiral James Stockdale, who was Perot's running mate back in 92. And Phil Hartman did a memorable impression of him at the time on SNL, which is why he comes to mind. But this one is interesting. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. on Tuesday announced what you had really been reporting, hinting at for several weeks now, which is that his running mate in his independent bid for president, which we should say is still only on the ballot in Utah, will be businesswoman, philanthropist, Sergey Brin's ex-wife, Nicole Shanahan. The reason this is interesting to you, Teddy, is that you've known her for a very long time. She was a figure in the world of philanthropy and Bay Area rich people that you know. Mm-hmm. And in reading your piece this week, profiling her, where she came from, one thing that jumped out at me was she really doesn't like the spotlight. She is a little bit interested in politics. She's given money to sort of dark money outside groups over the years. But it's surprising that she really wanted to step out on the stage and become RFK Jr.'s running mate and really subject herself to a kind of scrutiny that until this week, she really seemed like she didn't want.
Totally. I mean, she is somebody who everybody in Silicon Valley knows, and they're shocked. I'm shocked. You know, her involvement with RFK was sort of shocking on its own, right? The fact that she was going to put $4 million into a super PAC for him, that's pretty shocking. The fact that she was, you know, kind of integrating herself so closely with the campaign, that's shocking. The fact that she is the number two running for vice president of the United States, this fairly private woman who never before has sort of expressed any interest in being like the guy, you know, maybe she's comfortable being the guy behind the guy. She is about to kind of enter the Thunderdome in a way that I don't know if she is ready for. You know, there is opposition research already circulating on her. There is a level of scrutiny that is going to come upon Nicole that is fascinating. And I'm shocked as someone who, you know, we're not best friends or anything like that, but she's been somebody who I've been following for, you know, 5 or 6 years now. And the fact that she is striding across the stage at Oakland, you know, standing hand in hand with RFK and Cheryl Hines as the running mate. There's an Aaron Rodgers-ness to this that I can't believe is happening.
So I first came to knowledge of her like most people did, which is that she was married to Sergey Brin. And a couple of years ago, the Wall Street Journal, in a bit of iffy reporting, said she was at the center of a love triangle that with Sergey and Elon Musk, and that she slept with Elon Musk or dated Elon Musk. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, and I agree with her here, like suddenly her name was in the spotlight as a sexualized object, and she was furious about it. Again, to your point, doesn't seem like she wants to be in the spotlight. I know a little bit about her bio points, but for people listening, who exactly is this person, and why does RFK Jr. seem to think that there is some political asset here? What can she bring to the ticket other than, obviously, a lot of money?
So let's just start with the fact that she's pretty young, you know, 38. She's younger than you, Peter. You could be vice president if you were looking to be RFK's fourth or fifth choice. So she is somebody who kind of grew up pretty poor, or at least in a, you know, a troubled kind of upbringing in Oakland, which is where the announcement was on Tuesday. And, you know, she kind of was kind of enjoying, you know, kind of the party lifestyle of people in Silicon Valley in her 20s. And, you know, she got to know Sergey and, frankly, other people from kind of the tech billionaire set because she was in this community of kind of wellness-focused, you know, Burning Man types who are pretty powerful in Silicon Valley. So she met Sergey Brin at Wanderlust, which is a kind of well-known yoga festival near Lake Tahoe in 2014. And that sort of changed her life. Suddenly, you know, she went from just being, you know, the founder of kind of a patent law startup to being like part of the Sergey empire, right? And, you know, he's not just a regular rich guy. You know, he's one of the richest people in the world, $100 billion fiefdom that she was like a principal at. So, you know, to hear Nicole tell it, her life transformed. Suddenly, she was, you know, accompanying Sergey Brin to the Met Gala and being sort of the, you know, arm-in-arm partner to a guy who was doing extraordinarily ambitious things and had an extraordinary amount of money. Then, Peter, as you point out, she and Sergey got divorced, and it didn't really make that much of a dent, frankly, in the culture. You know, I was curious about Nicole. Mm-hmm. You know, how much money was she going to get out of this? Could she sort of focus on her own charitable efforts? But then this Wall Street Journal story happened. And, you know, the Journal, to be, you know, fair to them, you know, they say they stand by their story and their sourcing. But, you know, it certainly was challenged reporting by Elon and by Nicole Shanahan. They disagree that this quote-unquote liaison, which is the Wall Street Journal parlance for whatever you want to call their romantic alleged encounter, they dispute that this liaison happened, but, you know, the impacts on Nicole were pretty severe. You know, she felt like her life was, you know, now a tabloid fascination, and she was kind of caught between these two powerful men, and, you know, it was a dark time in her life. This is also around the same time that her child, her daughter, was diagnosed with autism, and that kind of led her down a rabbit hole where she was researching autism, and if you research autism long enough, you end up meeting Robert F. Kennedy Jr. So she started listening to more and more of his podcasts. You know, she spent a little bit of time with him. And lo and behold, she's gotten remarried and has sort of a new lease on life, in part because she has kind of become integrated with the RFK operation. And she was a donor to an outside group. She helped design that Super Bowl ad, Peter, that I know you thought was pretty successful, or at least was innovative at the time, and she put the money ahead for that. And, you know, the vice presidency kind of found her. You know, I'm told that she wasn't really seeking it out, but the RFK campaign obviously was casting a wide net from Jesse Ventura to Aaron Rodgers. And Nicole, who is, as I mentioned, young, you know, a woman, half Asian, and has sort of an interesting backstory and has a lot of passions that she shares with Robert F. Kennedy, ended up being the person that they wanted to choose. So, I mean, the other thing she brings to the table is obvious, and I don't think it is really a surprise, is she can put money into this campaign. There are no limits on contributions from people who are on the ticket. So, you know, she could put in $10, $20, $30, $40 million. I know that Nicole, in private conversations, has told people that she's planning to put a lot of money into this, or has at least heavily implied it. And I would expect that to happen pretty soon, which can help RFK make those ballots that you point out he is currently not on.
And it's also worth pointing out that in some states, to be on a ballot, either as a candidate or a political party, you need to have a ticket. And so that's why RFK Jr. kind of accelerated the usual timeline for selecting a running mate here. I was watching the live stream on X, and there were a lot of RFK Jr. fans in the live stream comments who were sort of anticipating what was going to happen, and they were kind of rooting for, some of them were rooting for Tulsi Gabbard, some of them were rooting for Aaron Rodgers, even though it was sort of clear they weren't in the mix. When Shanahan was announced as the running mate, when Kennedy said that, so many people in the comments section were like, I'm out, she's a Democratic plant, Nicole Soros. It was an interesting, obviously eclectic mix of very online people, not representative of the voting public. But I'm curious what else she believes in, to your knowledge. Like, what does she care about besides being somewhat of a vaccine skeptic? And then also, as a former campaign reporter, what did you make of her speech, having known her and seen her over the years, her performance?
Sure. I mean, you know, what she cares about is, you know, definitely, let's not undersell it. Like, she definitely is a vaccine skeptic. I think she cares about that issue, as I mentioned, because she has personal experience with, you know, a child with diagnosed autism. And, you know, let's put in our ritualistic statement about autism and vaccines and, you know, do your own research. But also, it's, you know, clear what the research shows. But we've noted that now for the record. You know, she also believes she is sort of a criminal justice reformer. You know, she has some progressive people in her circle. And it's interesting to see, like, the Trump people going after her as a lefty, when during her speech, you know, she was talking about all the ways she felt disappointed by the left, in the same way that Bobby Kennedy did, of course, and that she called herself a disillusioned Democrat who, you know, felt that her party had left her. I thought her speech was actually pretty good. I thought she came across as like a normal, relatable person, you know, especially, maybe I'm judging her on a curve, but as a first time candidate, you know, who, you know, she's obviously in the highest profile. One more time. This is obviously the highest profile thing she's ever done. So maybe I'm grading her on a curve, but I thought she did pretty well. You know, she was emotional at times. Like, there were moments where she was fighting back tears, and I thought she came across as very normal and certainly cutting through the kind of the typical political speak that you often see. But look, I mean, let's not overstate this. I do not think that there are voters out there who are going to be voting for or against Nicole Shanahan. You know, this is a ticket that is about a cult of personality, about Kennedy himself. I think her primary impact on this will be financial, which matters for spoiler reasons or for reasons having to do with kind of how Trump or Biden are elected. I do not think Nicole Shanahan will be the next vice president of the United States, which is why some of the oppo that Democrats are circulating and calling her, like, you know, a heartbeat away from the presidency, and, you know, having all these like Sarah Palin comparisons. It's like, let's be clear. She is not going to be a heartbeat away from the presidency anytime soon, but she is going to shape the race just through the money. And I do think that, you know, there's a reason why RFK allies, I am told, have recently been informed that their financial problems are going to go away soon, which is what I've reported in my story. And that's, you know, the wink and the nod to the Nicole factor. And we'll see how much she puts in.
The Biden campaign and the DNC have started a super PAC that Liz Smith is leading. And she came out guns blazing yesterday attacking Shanahan with a message that I think is actually kind of potent against both of them. RFK's appeal right now is substantial and noticeable among Black voters and young voters. Liz and other Democrats who, you know, are taking the third party threat seriously, it appears, are painting both Kennedy and Shanahan as rich elites, out of touch elites. I mean, I saw Kennedy speak in Costa Mesa a few weeks ago. He can't help but mention the time he ran into somebody when he was in Jackson Hole or Aspen, and, you know, his Kennedy roots. And like, Shanahan is sort of the same level wealth. So, you know, expect Democrats to attack them as like the Aspen set so as to make them unrelatable to black voters and young voters in particular. I think that's a potent line of attack, but we'll see how much time she actually spends on the campaign trail versus behind the scenes.
Peter, I also totally love the irony that Liz Smith and kind of the Pete Mafia are leading the brigade against RFK and Nicole Shanahan, who in 2020 was a Pete Buttigieg max out donor. It just shows you kind of how 4 years can pass. You can go from being a Pete financial backer to being the attacked running mate of Joe Biden and a charge led by Pete AIDS. I mean, that's just the passage of time right there.
I would not want to be attacked by Liz. If there was anyone coming after me from the Democratic Party, it would not be Liz who I would choose. Teddy, good luck at the sentencing. Enjoy the train ride. Thanks for joining me.
You bet.
When we come back, Bill Cohan is here to talk about Donald Trump's Truth Social windfall.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Welcome back and hello to Bill Cohan joining us through the magic of my computer screen. Bill, welcome to the program. Nice to see you.
Thank you, Ben. Always great to be here with you.
Bill, I want to talk to you about the financial phenomenon of Trump's social media company, which, as most people know, merged this week after months of headaches with a SPAC, a special kind of shell company, so that it could go public and begin trading on the stock market. You've been following the story for a long, long time. Obviously, this merger has been years in the making, but I want to talk about some of the after effects, because I don't think most people are really grappling with how big this is and what it all means. First of all, Bill, how unusual is it that this company, which made something like $4 million last year and lost about $50 million, is valued today, as we're recording this, at around $8.5 billion?
You know, Ben, I've been around, long enough. Once upon a time, this would be, absurd, right? I mean, literally, absurd that a company that had $4 million in revenue, last year, and it's basically just, one guy's random thoughts that he puts, into messages a few times a day and puts online, and that lost $50 million last year, could somehow be worth, like $8.6 billion at the moment. But, once upon a time, that would have been inconceivable. Once upon a time, $8.6 billion for a company, would have made it one of the largest companies, in the world. But of course, now we're in an era where, you know, what, Microsoft is worth around $3 trillion, Apple around that. I mean, so now all of a sudden, you know, $8 billion doesn't seem like that much. Of course, Donald owns 60% of it. So, you know, now he's kind of worth, like, got $5 billion more on paper. I mean, this is just like manna from heaven from him coming at a time. As I've said, he's like the luckiest person on earth, Ben. I mean, you know, just when he needs $500 million or $175 million or whatever millions he needs, you know, he gets this manna from heaven, and now it's trading up off a little bit today, but still trading at ridiculous levels. And, you know, now his 60% is worth close to $5 billion. It's absolutely, you know, I mean, you couldn't, even if you wrote a novel and predicted something like this, science fiction or something, and predicted something like this would happen, no one would believe you.
And Bill, the money you mentioned that he owes, this you're referring to the $500 million or so in various civil fines that he owes to the state of New York, to E. Jean Carroll, yes, for defamation. He's contesting those, but he has still needed, yes, to post a pretty sizable bond. Which again, he's also in the midst of contesting, and they lowered the amount that he would need to post, but it's still a lot. I mean, it's, you know, over $100 million at least.
Correct. I mean, you know, he's already posted a bond for like 90 plus million in the E. Jean Carroll case, which allows him to appeal and contest it. He was going to have to post a bond of something, you know, with interest and everything of over $500 million to contest the civil fraud case in New York State. That got reduced, again, a gift from the Court of Appeals earlier this week, to $175 million, and he's got 10 days to do it. And then, boom, the next day, you know, Truth Social, you know, Trump Media and Technology Group goes public, merges with the SPAC after a couple of years, and, you know, it trades like a crazy man, like a meme stock. You know, we also live in this era of these meme stocks. I mean, when, you know, retail investors just kind of lose their minds and decide they're going to, you know, push up the value of a stock, even though the fundamentals are completely unrelated to the valuation. And you know, we saw that with, you know, AMC, we saw that with GameStop, we saw it with Hertz when it was in bankruptcy. I mean, so Kel Sapris, you know, Donald Trump and his followers, are willing to do this, and are essentially doing it, you know, for him, because there's no basis upon which this thing should be trading anything like the way it's trading, and, you know, should be technically, you know, destined for a fall, you know, sort of not unlike, you know, why was Tesla trading at close to $1 trillion and at one point worth more than all the other 10 largest car companies combined? And, you know, we live in a very strange era, Ben, when this is just one of the many strange things that are happening that are untethered to reality.
Well, I want to get into that, the sort of political ramifications of a presidential candidate essentially controlling a meme stock. I mean, this is like a black box that anyone can just throw money into. But just to linger on the civil fines that he owes, the big problem that his lawyers were claiming is that Trump, you know, he claims he's so wealthy, and he is obviously a very wealthy man. A lot of that wealth is illiquid. It's tied up in real estate. It's not easy for him to get that money easily. Now he has this huge bonanza with Truth Social going public. He's sitting on billions of dollars in paper wealth. But Bill, technically, he's not allowed to sell those shares, right? Can you talk a little bit about some of the complexity around that?
Yeah. So, you know, he can't just turn this $5 billion windfall into cash and transfer the money into his bank account. I'm sure he'd like to do that, and he might even be exploring ways to do that, because obviously he needs the money and would love to have the money. I mean, because, you know, shares in this SPAC are not the same as cash. And there are also a number of restrictions that apply. The first restriction is that there are lockup provisions in the SPAC which prevent him from selling his shares for 6 months. You know, that's number one. That's to protect the other investors in this crazy thing. Because if, you know, Donald owns 60% of the stock, if a 60% shareholder just, you know, decided to sell his or her stock, then that would purely on a supply and demand basis would, you know, tank the stock. So that's designed to, you know, let the stock sort of reach a level where, you know, and usually after 6 months, it will have reached a level of kind of quote unquote ordinary trading, although it being a meme stock, it may never be a quote unquote trading ordinarily, you know, to let things settle down. But that's just one thing. And that can be waived, whether it's by the board or the underwriter, that can be waived. And considering he controls the board with his cronies and his son, I'm sure they'd be more than happy to give him a waiver. So, but that's only one thing. You know, there's also, you know, securities rules. He is obviously, you know, if he's not a controlling shareholder, he's certainly an affiliated shareholder. And there are rules that basically would prevent him from selling any shares for another 6 months, regardless of whether he gets this waiver. And even at that point, he would be limited in how much stock he can sell after 6 months, and that would be limited to something like 1% of the greater of, you know, 1% of his holdings, or, you know, the average trading volume, you know, over a, say, a 30-day period or something. So he would, again, be limited to how much stock he could sell sort of, you know, in the market. So that's two things. You'd have to wait the 6 months anyway, and then he would have to, you know, there'd be restrictions on the amount of stock that he could sell, again, designed to protect the other shareholders. He could also, you know, do other things to sell the stock. He could, you know, the company could do a secondary, you know, offering, or, you know, register his stock. And in a separate registration, filing with the SEC that the SEC would have to approve, and then they would actually say how much stock Donald wanted to sell of what he owned, and that can happen before 6 months. But of course, you know, secondary offerings like that tend to also drive the stock price down. But again, you know, this is like manna from heaven for him, so I'm sure he doesn't care about that too much. And then I think the third thing he could do is do sort of like a 144A private placement, where he could sell some of his stock to somebody who's, you know, a sophisticated investor, someone who's got a relatively high net worth, his friend, Yass or whatever his name is, who owns
You know, or John Paulson. You're saying he could just give like $1 billion in share to John Paulson his current value.
Sell.
But at presumably an inflated value if they wanted to go.
Well, the whole thing is
like
inflated.
That.
The whole thing is inflated.
No, I mean, of course, Bill. The whole thing is worthless.
It's pretty close to worthless, yes. But at the moment, it's worth $8.5 billion. So, I mean, you know, if he's got billionaire friends who want to help him out of his quote unquote predicament, that raises whole other questions about whether we want, you know, our Republican nominee for president, who might be president again, beholden to somebody who did a $500 million favor for him. The whole thing, Ben, is beyond absurd.
Well, Bill, this gets back to the political and legal question that I wanted to end on here with you, which, yeah, to your point, I mean, this thing essentially operates as a piggy bank, a black box piggy bank where anyone can throw money into it. There's no campaign disclosures. There's no campaign finance restrictions here. Now, obviously, if someone wanted to give money to Trump through this company, it would be a pretty inefficient way to do it, because you'd be bidding up the value of these shares. Trump only owns 60%. As you were saying, he can't exactly sell all 60% of the company that he owns without tanking the stock. He'd have to do it piecemeal. So granted, lots of caveats here. But, you know, as a way to essentially bank political favors, I don't think we've ever seen anything like this in the history of presidential politics.
No, because most presidents, you know, put their assets into a blind trust, or, you know, that are then sold, and then the proceeds are put into a blind trust so that, you know, he avoids any appearance of conflict or favoritism or anything that looks like that. Donald Trump, of course, decided not to do any of that. You know, he's not president now. He's a presidential candidate, and, you know, one of two. And that are, you know, from the major parties, you know, he just flaunts all the traditional rules, as we know, and he, you know, remains, you know, Teflon. I mean, you know, if this, I mean, can you imagine he'd be in a totally different, you know, economic and legal position if this hadn't happened. But, you know, as I say, he's the luckiest guy on the face of the earth, and this did happen, and, you know, he must be dancing a jig because, you know, he doesn't care about this. This is literally found money from him. He doesn't care about this company. It's not like he cares about 40 Wall Street, or he cares about Trump Tower, or Doral, or Mar-a-Lago, all of which might have been taken from him to satisfy this judgment. If, you know, now he can just turn to this pig and sell it to, you know, his, you know, gleeful, unsuspecting investors who either are too stupid to realize what's going on or couldn't care less and want to help him out.
Bill, got to leave it there, but couldn't happen to a nicer guy, obviously.
Yes.
Spectacular story. We'll see what happens with all this, whether he can sell it, when he sells it, whether he tanks the stock and turns all of his supporters into bag holders. But Bill, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of The Powers That Be. As a reminder, The Powers That Be is the official podcast of Puck. We'd like to thank Ben Landy, Liz Goff, and Alex Bigler for their editorial and production guidance. If you like what you hear, please share with a friend. It really helps us keep delivering the inside scoop that only Puck can offer. Follow us on Twitter at Puck News. I'm Ben Landy. See you tomorrow. This has been a presentation of Odyssey. Please listen, rate, review, and follow all episodes wherever you get your podcasts. The Powers That Be Daily is executive produced by John Kelly, co-founder of Puck, Bob Tabador, and Ben Landy, executive editor at Puck.